but totally sure of his role.
"And we must," said Arbedarch, "develop an aggressive attitude to defense. We have seen ourselves that Ulrich is stripping whole forests in order to build his ballistae and siege towers. We must have inflammables, also containers for them." For over an hour, as the dawn breasted the eastern horizon, the leaders set about their plans, eliminating some ideas, refining and expanding others. Finally, Serbitar called on them to join hands. Arbedarch, Menahem, and Vintar relaxed their control, drifting down into the darkness as Serbitar drew their power to him. "Truss! Truss!" he pulsed, his mind soaring across the ocean, past Dros Purdol, the port fortress, on along the Delnog range, past the Setuli settlements, over the vast Sentran plain. Faster and faster he flew. Dros awoke with a start, blue eyes scanning the room, nostrils flared to scent danger in the air. He shook his head. Someone was saying his name, but there was no sound. Swiftly he made the sign of the claw over his heart. Still someone called him. Cold sweat appeared on his brow. He reached across the bed, snatching Snugger from the chair by the wall. "Listen to me, Truss," pleaded the voice.
"Get out of my head, you whoreson,"
bellowed the old man, rolling from the bed.
"I am of the 30. We are travelling to Dros Delnok to aid you. Listen to me.
Get out of my head!"
Serbitar had no choice, for the pain was incredible. He released the old warrior and returned to the ship. Dros staggered to his feet, fell and rose again. The door opened and Kalvar Sin moved swiftly to him.
"I told you not to get up before noon," he snapped.
"Voices," said Dros. "Voices inside my head. Lie down. Now listen. You are the captain, and you expect men to obey you. That's what discipline is about. I am the surgeon, and I expect to be obeyed by my patients. Now, tell me about the voices."
Dros laid his head on the pillow and closed his eyes. His head ached abominably, and his stomach was still queasy.
"There was only one voice. It said my name. Then it said it was from the 30, and that they were coming to aid us."
"Is that all?"
"Yes. What is happening to me, Kalvar? I've never had this before, from a blow on the head."
"It could be the blow. Concussion can cause some very strange effects, including seeing visions and hearing voices. But they rarely last. Take my advice, Dros. The worst thing you can do at the moment is get overexcited. You could black out, or worse. Blows to the head can be fatal, even after a period of several days. I want you to rest and relax, and if the voice comes again, listen to it, even reply to it. But do not become alarmed. Understand?"
"Of course I understand," said Dros. "I don't normally panic, Doctor. But some things I do not like."
"I know that, Dros. Do you need something to help you sleep now?"
"No. Wake me at noon. I have to judge a contest of swordsmanship."
"And don't fret," he said, seeing the gleam of annoyance in the surgeon's one good eye.
"I shall not get excited, and I will come straight back to bed afterwards."
Outside the room, Hogun and Orin waited. Kalvar Sin joined them, signalled for silence, and beckoned them to a nearby office.
"I'm not happy," he told them. "He's hearing voices, and believe me, that is not a good sign. But he's strong as a bull."
"Is he in any danger?" asked Hogun. "It's hard to say. This morning I didn't think so. But he has been under a lot of strain recently, and that may not help his condition. And although it is easy to forget, he is no longer a young man."
"What about the voices?" said Orin. "Could he go mad?"
"I think I would bet against that," replied Kalvar. "He said it was a message from the 30. Earl Delnar told me he had sent Virai to them with a message, and it could be that they have a speaker among them. Or it could be someone of Ulrich's. He also has speakers among his shaman. I have told Drust to relax and listen to any future voices and report them to me.
That one old man is vital to us, said Orin softly. Do everything you can, Calvar. It would be a hammer blow to morale if anything happened to him.
Do you think I don't know that? Snapped the surgeon.
The banquet to celebrate the open swords was a raucous affair. All who had reached the last 100 were invited. Officers and enlisted men were seated side by side, swapping jests, tales, and tall, tall stories. Gillard was seated between Bar Britann, who had beaten him soundly, and Don Pinar, who had in turn vanquished Britann. The black-bearded Bar was cursing Pinar good-humouredly, and complaining that the latter's wooden sword lacked the balance of his own cavalry sabre.
"I'm surprised you didn't ask to be allowed to fight on horseback," said Pinar.
"But I did," protested Britann, "and they offered me the target pony."
The three men burst into laughter, which others joined as the joke spread around the table. The target pony was a saddle tied to a moving rail and pulled by ropes. It was used for archery practice and jousting. As the wine flowed, Gillard relaxed. He had seriously considered missing the banquet, fearing that his background would leave him ill at ease with the officer class. He had only agreed to come when the men of his group had lobbied him, pointing out that he was the only member of Karnak who had reached the last 100. Now he was glad he had been persuaded. Bar Britann was a dry, witty companion, while Pinar, despite his breeding, or perhaps because of it, made Gillard feel among friends. At the far end of the table sat Drass, flanked by Hogun and Orin, while beside them sat the archer leader from Skultik. Gillard knew nothing about the man, save that he had brought 600 bowmen to the dross. Hogun, in full legion dress armour of silver breastplate edged with ebony and black and silver mail shirt, stared at the silver sword lying on the table before Drass. The final had been watched by more than 5,000 soldiers as Hogun and Orin took their places. The first strike had been Hogun's, a neat parry and riposte after a 4-minute duel. The second had been Orin's, following a feint to the head. Hogun had blocked swiftly, but a subtle twist of the wrist sent his opponent's wooden blade down to touch Hogun's side. After some 20 minutes, Hogun led by 2-1, one strike from victory. During the first break, Drass strolled to where Hogun and his seconds sat drinking watered wine in the shade of Wall 1.
"Nice work," said Drass. "He's good, though."
"Yes," said Hogun, wiping the sweat from his brow with a white towel. "But he is not as strong on the right."
"True, but you are slow against the leg cut."
"A lancer's main fault. It comes from too much work in the saddle," said Hogun. "He is shorter than I, which gives him an advantage in that respect."
"True. It has done Orin good to reach the final. His cheers outnumber yours, I think."
"Yes, but that will not disturb me," said Hogun.
"I hope it does not," said Drass. "Still, nothing could be better for morale than seeing the fortress gun perform so well."
Hogun glanced up, holding Drass's gaze. Then the old warrior smiled and moved back to his judge's seat. "What was that about?" asked Elikas, walking behind Hogun and kneading the muscles of his neck and shoulder.
"Encouraging words?"
"Yes," said Hogun. "Do some work on the forearm, will you? The muscles are knotted there." The young general grunted as Elikas probed the flesh with his powerful thumbs. Was Drass asking him to lose? Surely not. And yet, it would do no harm for Orin to win the silver sword, and would certainly increase his growing standing with the troops.
"What are you thinking?" asked Elikas.
"I'm thinking that he's weak on the right."
"You will take him, Hogun," said the young officer. "Try that vicious parry riposte you used on me."
At 2-even, Hogan's wooden blade snapped. Orin stepped back, allowing a replacement, and offered his opponent a swift practice with the new weapon. Hogun was unhappy with the balance and changed the sword again. He needed time to think. Had Drass suggested he lose?
"You're not concentrating," said Elikas sternly. "What's the matter with you? The Legion has a lot of wages tied up in this tourney."
"I know." His mind cleared.
No matter what the reason, he could not fight to lose. He threw everything he could into the last attack, blocked a backhand sweep, and lunged. Just before his blade thudded against Orin's belly, however, the gun's sword tapped his neck. Orin had read the move and lured him in. In real combat, both men would have died, but this was not real combat, and Orin had won. The two men shook hands as the cheering soldiers swarmed forward.
"That's my money gone," said Elikas. "Still, there is a bright side."
"What's that?" said Hogan, rubbing at his burning forearm.
"I cannot afford to settle our own bet. You will have to stand for the wine. It's the least you can do, Hogan, after letting down the Legion."
The banquet lifted Hogan's spirits, and the speeches from Bar Britan on behalf of the soldiers and Don Pinar for the officers were witty and short. The food was good, the wine and ale plentiful, and the camaraderie reassuring.
"It is hardly the same dross," thought Hogan.
Outside at the portcullis gates, Bregan stood sentry duty with a tall young cull from Group Fire. Bregan didn't know his name and couldn't ask, since sentries were forbidden to talk on duty. A strange rule, thought Bregan, but there to be obeyed. The night was chill, but he barely noticed it. His thoughts were back in the village with Lotis and the children. Sebad had received a letter that day, and all was well. Legan, Bregan's 5-year-old son, was mentioned. It seemed that when he climbed a tall elm and couldn't get down, he had cried and called for his father. Bregan had asked Sebad to write a few words for him in his next letter home. He had wanted him to say how much he loved and missed them all, but he couldn't bring himself to ask Sebad to pen such endearments. Instead, he asked him to tell Legan to be a good boy and obey his mother. Sebad took notes from all the villagers and spent the early evening composing the letter, which was sealed in wax and delivered to the mailroom. A rider would carry it south with other letters and army dispatches for Drennan. Lotis would have banked the fire by now and doused the lamps, Bregan thought. She would be lying in their rush-filled bed, probably asleep. Legan would be asleep beside her, he knew, for Lotis always found it difficult to sleep alone when Bregan was away.
"You will stop the savages, Daddy, won't you?"
"Yes," Bregan had told him, "but they probably won't come. The politicians will sort it out, just like they have always done before."
"Will you be home soon?"
"I'll be back for harvest supper."
"Promise?"
"I promise."
The banquet over, Druss invited Orin, Hogan, Elikas, and Bowman to the Earl's study above the great hall. The servant Arshin brought them wine, and Druss introduced the outlaw to the fortress leaders. Orin shook hands coolly, his eyes showing his distaste. For 2 years he had sent patrols into Skultik with orders to catch and hang the outlaw leader. Hogan was less concerned with Bowman's pedigree and more interested in the skills the outlaws could bring. Elikas had no preconceived opinion, but instinctively liked the blonde archer. Once seated, Bowman cleared his throat and told them the size of the Nadir horde gathered at Golgothir.
"How do you come by this intelligence?" asked Orin.
3 days ago we met some travellers in Skultik. They were journeying from Dros Purdol to Segril and had come across the northern desert. They were waylaid near Golgothir and taken into the city, where they stayed for 4 days. Because they were Vagrian merchants, they were treated civilly, but questioned by a Nadir officer called Surib. One of them is a former Vagrian officer, and he made the estimate of their strength.
"But 500,000? said Orin.
"I thought the figure was exaggerated."
"Underplayed, if anything," said Bowman. "Outlying tribes were still coming in when he left. I'd say you will have quite a battle on your hands."
"I don't wish to be pedantic," said Hogan, "but do you not mean we have a battle on our hands?" Bowman glanced at Druss.
"Have you not told them, old horse?" "No." "Ah, what a deliciously embarrassing moment, to be sure."
"Told us what?" asked Orin.
"That they are mercenaries," said Druss uneasily. "They stay only until the fall of Wall 3. It has been agreed."
"And for this pitiful age, they expect pardons?" shouted Orin, rising to his feet. "I will see them swing first."
"After Wall 3 we will have less need of archers,"
said Hogan calmly. There is no killing ground.
We need archers, Orin, said Druss. We need them badly. And this man has 600 of the finest. We know walls will fall, and we will need every shaft. The postern gates will be sealed by then. I don't like this situation either, but needs must. Better to have cover for the first three walls than to have none at all. Do you agree?
And if I don't? Said the gun, still angry.
Then I shall send them away, said Druss.
Hogan began an angry outburst, but was silenced by a wave of Druss's hand.
You are the gun, Orin. It is your decision.
Orin sat down, breathing deeply. He had made many mistakes before Druss arrived. He knew that now. This situation angered him deeply, but he had no choice but to back the axeman. And Druss knew it too. The two men exchanged glances and smiled.
They shall stay, said Orin.
A wise decision, said Bowman. How soon will the Nadir arrive, do you think?
Too damned soon, muttered Druss. Sometime within the next 3 weeks, according to our scouts. Ulrich lost a son, which has given us a few more days, but it's still not enough.
For some time the men discussed the many problems facing the defenders. Finally Bowman spoke, this time hesitantly.
Look here, Druss, there is something I feel I should mention, but I don't want to be thought strange. I've been toying with the idea of not mentioning it, but...
Speak on, laddie, you're among friends, mostly.
I had a strange dream last night, and you appeared in it. I would have dismissed it, but seeing you today made me think again. I dreamed I was woken from a deep sleep by a warrior in silver armor. I could see right through him, as if he was a ghost. He told me that he had been trying to contact you, but without success. When he spoke, it was like a voice in my mind. He said that his name was Serbitar, and that he was travelling with his friends and a woman called Virai. He said it was important for me to tell you to collect inflammables and containers, since Ulrich has built great siege towers. He also suggested fire gullies across the spaces between walls. In my mind he showed me a vision of you being attacked. He told me a name, Musa. Does any of it make any sense?
For a moment no one spoke, although Druss seemed hugely relieved.
Indeed it does, laddie. Indeed it does.
Hogan poured a fresh glass of Lentrian and passed it to Bowman. What did this warrior look like? He asked.
Tall, slender. I think his hair was white, though he was young.
It is Serbitar, said Hogan. The vision is a true one. You know him? Asked Druss.
Of him only. He is the son of Earl Drada of Dros Segril. It is said that the boy was fey and had a demon. He could read men's thoughts. He is an albino, and as you know, the Vagrians consider this an ill omen. He was sent to the Temple of the 30, south of Drenan, when he was about 13. It is also said that his father tried to smother him when he was a babe, but that the child sensed him coming and hid outside his bedroom window. These, of course, are but stories.
Well, his talents have grown, it seems, said Druss. But I don't give a damn. He'll be useful here, especially if he can read Ulrich's mind.
Chapter 15. For 10 days work progressed. Fire gullies 10 yards wide were dug 4 feet deep across the open ground between walls 1 and 2, and again between walls 3 and 4. These were filled with brushwood and small timber, while vats were placed along each gully, ready to pour oils to the dry wood. Bowman's archers hammered white stakes in the open ground at various points between walls, and also out on the plain before the fortress. Each line of stakes represented 60 paces, and his men practiced for several hours each day, black clouds of shafts slicing the air above each row as the commands were shouted. Target dummies were set up on the plain, only to be splintered by scores of arrows, even at 120 paces. The skills of the Skultic archers were formidable. Hogan rehearsed withdrawals, timing the men by drumbeats as they dashed from the battlements across the plank bridges of the fire gullies to scale the ropes to the next wall. Each day they became more swift. Minor points began to occupy more time as the overall fitness and readiness of the troops increased. "When do we add the oil?" Hogan asked Druss as the men took an afternoon break.
"Between walls 1 and 2 it will have to be filled on the day of the first attack. Until the first day we will have no real idea of how well the men will stand up to the assault."
"There remains the problem," added Orin, "of who lights the gullies and when. For example, if the wall is breached, we could have Nadir tribesmen racing side by side with our own men. No easy decision to throw in a lighted torch."
"And if we give men the duty," said Hogan, "what happens if they are killed on the wall?"
"We will have to have a torch duty," said Druss, "and the decision will be relayed by a bugler from Wall 2. An officer of cool nerve will be needed to judge the issue. When the bugle sounds, the gully goes up, no matter who is left behind."
Matters such as these occupied Druss more and more, until his head swam with plans, ideas, stratagems, and ploys. Several times during such discussions, the old man's temper flared and his huge fists hammered the table, or else he strode around the room like a caged bear.
"I'm a soldier, not a damned planner," he would announce, and the meeting would be adjourned for an hour.
Combustibles were carted in from outlying villages. A seemingly endless number of dispatches arrived from Drennan and Abilene's panicked government, and a multitude of small problems concerning delayed mail, new recruits, personal worries, and squabbles between groups threatened to overwhelm the three men. One officer complained that the latrine area of Wall 1 was in danger of causing a health hazard, since it was not of regulation depth and lacked an adequate cesspit. Druss set a working party to enlarge the area.
Abilene himself demanded a complete strategic appraisal of all Drosdale Nock's defences, which Druss refused, since the information could be leaked to Nadir sympathisers. This in turn brought a swift rebuke from Drennan and a firm request for an apology. Orin penned this, claiming it would keep the politicians off their backs. Then Woundweaver sent a requisition for the Legion's mounts, claiming that since the order was to hold to the last man, the horses would be of little use at Delnock. He allowed that 20 should be retained for dispatch purposes. This so enraged Hogan that he was unapproachable for days. Added to this, the burghers had begun to complain about the rowdy behaviour of the troops in civilian areas. All in all, Druss was beginning to feel at the end of his tether, and had begun to voice openly his desire that the Nadir would arrive and the devil with the consequences. 3 days later, his wish was partly answered. A Nadir troop, under a flag of truce, galloped in from the north. Word spread like wildfire, and by the time it reached Druss in the main hall of the keep, an air of panic was abroad in the town. The Nadir dismounted in the shadow of the great gates and waited. They did not speak. From their pack saddles they took dried meat and water sacks, and sat together, eating and waiting. By the time Druss arrived with Orin and Hogan, they had completed their meal. Druss bellowed down from the battlements,
"What is your message?"
"Open the gates,"
called back the Nadir officer, a short barrel-chested man, bow-legged and powerful.
"Are you the Death Walker?"
called the man.
"Yes."
"You are old and fat. It pleases me."
"Good. Remember that when next we meet, for I have marked you, Loudmouth, and my axe knows the name of your spirit. Now, what is your message?"
"The Lord Ulrich, Prince of the North, bids me to tell you that he will be riding to Drennan to discuss an alliance with Abilene, Lord of the Drenai. He wishes it known that he expects the gates of Drosdilnok to be open to him, that, being so, he guarantees there will be no harm to any man, woman or child, soldier or otherwise, within the city. It is the Lord Ulrich's wish that the Drenai and the Nadir become as one nation. He offers the gift of friendship."
"Tell the Lord Ulrich," said Druss, "that he is welcome to ride to Drennan at any time. We will even allow an escort of 100 warriors, as befits a prince of the north.
The Lord Ulrich allows no conditions, said the officer. These are my conditions. They shall not change, said Druss. Then I have a second message. Should the walls be contested and the gates closed, the Lord Ulrich wishes it known that every second defender taken alive will be slain, and that all the women will be sold into slavery, and that one in three of all citizens will lose his right hand.
Before that can happen, laddie, the Lord Ulrich has to take the Druss. Now you give him this message from Druss the Deathwalker. In the north, the mountains may tremble as he breaks wind, but this is Drenai land, and as far as I am concerned, he is a pot-bellied savage who couldn't pick his own nose without a Drenai map. Do you think you can remember that, laddie, or shall I carve it on your ass in large letters?
Inspiring as your words were, Druss, said Orin, I must tell you that my stomach turned over as you spoke them. Ulrich will be furious.
Would that he were, said Druss bitterly, as the Nadir troop galloped back to the north. If that were the case, he would truly be just a pot-bellied savage. No, he will laugh, loud and long.
Why should he? Asked Hogun.
Because he has no choice. He has been insulted and should lose face. When he laughs, the men will laugh with him.
It was a pretty offer he made, said Orin, as the three men made the long walk back to the keep. Word will spread. Talks with Abilene, one empire of Drenai and Nadir. Clever.
Clever and true, said Hogun. We know from his record that he means it. If we surrender, he will march through and harm no one. Threats of death can be taken and resisted. Offers of life are horses of a different colour. I wonder how long it will be before the burghers demand another audience.
Before dusk, predicted Druss.
Back on the walls, Gilad and Bregan watched the dust from the Nadir horsemen dwindle into the distance.
What did he mean, Gil, about riding to Drenan for discussions with Abilene?
He meant he wants us to let his army through.
Oh, they didn't look terribly fierce, did they? I mean, they seem quite ordinary, really, save that they wear furs.
Yes, they are ordinary, said Gilad, removing his helm and combing his hair with his fingers, allowing the cool breeze to get to his head. Very ordinary, except that they live for war. Fighting comes as naturally to them as farming does to you. Or me, he added as an afterthought, knowing this to be untrue.
I wonder why, said Bregan. It has never made much sense to me. I mean, I understand why some men become soldiers, to protect the nation and all that. But a whole race of people living to be soldiers seems unhealthy. Does that sound right?
Gilad laughed. Indeed, it sounds right. But the northern steppes make poor farmland. Mainly they breed goats and ponies. Any luxuries they desire, they must steal. Now to the Nadir, so Dun Pinar told me at the banquet, the word for stranger is the same as the word for enemy. Anyone not of the tribe is simply there to be killed and stripped of goods. It is a way of life. Smaller tribes are wiped out by larger tribes. Ulrich changed the pattern. By amalgamating beaten tribes into his own, he grew more and more powerful. He controls all the northern kingdoms now, and many to the east. 2 years ago, he took Mania, the Sea Kingdom.
I heard about that, said Bregan, but I thought he had withdrawn after making a treaty with the king.
Dun Pinar says the king agreed to be Ulrich's vassal, and Ulrich holds the king's son hostage. The nation is his.
He must be a pretty clever man, said Bregan. But what would he do if he ever conquered the whole world? I mean, what good is it?
I would like a bigger farm and a house with several floors. That I can understand.
But what would I do with 10 farms? Or 100?
You would be rich and powerful. Then you could tell your tenant farmers what to do, and they would all bow as you rode past in your fine carriage.
That doesn't appeal to me. Not at all, said Bregan.
Well, it does to me, said Gilad.
I've always hated it when I had to tug the forelock for some passing nobleman on a tall horse. The way they look at you, despising you because you work a small holding, paying more money for their handmade boots than I can earn in a year of slaving. No, I wouldn't mind being rich, so pig-awful rich that no man could ever look down on me again.
Gillard turned his face away to stare out over the plains, his anger fierce, almost tangible.
"Would you look down on people then, Gil? Would you despise me because I wanted to remain a farmer? Of course not. A man should be free to do what he wants to do as long as it doesn't hurt others. Maybe that's why Ulrich wants to control everything. Maybe he is sick of everyone looking down on the nadir."
Gilad turned back to Bregan, and his anger died within him.
"Do you know, Breg, that's just what Pinar said when I asked him if he hated Ulrich for wanting to smash the Drenai. He said, Ulrich isn't trying to smash the Drenai, but to raise the nadir. I think Pinar admires him."
"The man I admire is Orin," said Bregan. "He must have taken great courage to come out and train with the men as he has done, especially being as unpopular as he was. I was so pleased when he won back the swords."
"Only because you won 5 silver pieces on him," Gilad pointed out.
"That's not fair, Gil. I backed him because he was Karnak. I backed you, too.
You backed me for 1/4 copper and him for 1/2 silver, according to Dribus, who took your bet."
Bregan tapped his nose, smiling.
"Ah, but then you don't pay the same price for a goat as for a horse. But the thought was there. After all, I knew you couldn't win.
I damn near had that bar, Britan. It was the judge's decision at the last."
"True," said Bregan, "but you would never have beaten Pinar, or that fellow with the earring from the Legion. But what's even more to the point, you never could have beaten Orin. I've seen you both fence."
"Such judgment," said Gilad. "It's small wonder to me that you didn't enter yourself, so great is your knowledge."
"I don't have to fly in order to know that the sky is blue," said Bregan. "Anyway, who did you back?"
"Dan Hogan."
"Who else?" "Drebber said you had placed 2 bets, said Bregan innocently.
"You know very well Drebber would have told you."
"I didn't think to ask."
"Liar."
"Well, I don't care. I backed myself to reach the last 50.
"And you were so close," said Bregan. "Only 1 strike in it. One lucky blow and I could have won 1 month's wages.
"Such is life," said Bregan. "Maybe next year you can come back and have another try."
"And maybe corn will grow on the backs of camels," said Gilad.
Back at the keep, Druss was struggling to keep his temper as the city elders argued back and forth about the nadir offer. Word had spread to them with bewildering speed, and Druss had barely managed to eat a chunk of bread and cheese before a messenger from Orin informed him that the elders had called a meeting. It was a Drenai rule long established that except in time of battle the elders had a democratic right to see the city lord and debate matters of importance. Neither Orin nor Druss could refuse. No one could argue that Ulrich's ultimatum was unimportant. 6 men constituted the city elders, an elected body which effectively ruled all trade within the city. The master burgher and chief elder was Bricklin, who had entertained Druss so royally on the night of the assassination attempt. Malfar, Bakdar, Shinel, and Alphus were all merchants, while Beric was a nobleman, a distant cousin of Earl Delnar, and highly placed in city life. Only lack of real fortune kept him at Delnoch and away from Drenan, which he loved. Shinel, a fat, oily silk merchant, was the main cause of Druss's anger.
"But surely we have a right to discuss Ulrich's terms and must be allowed a say in whether they are accepted or rejected," he said again. "It is a vital interest to the city, after all, and by right of law our vote must carry."
"You know full well, my dear Shinel," said Orin smoothly, "that the city elders have full rights to discuss all civil matters. This situation hardly falls within that category. Nevertheless, your point of view is noted."
Malfar, a red-faced wine dealer of Lentrian stock, interrupted Chanel as he began his protest.
"We're getting nowhere with this talk of rules and precedent.
The fact remains that we are virtually at war. Is it a war we can win?
His green eyes scanned the faces around him, and Drust tapped his fingers on the tabletop, the only outward sign of his tensions.
Is it a war we can carry long enough to force an honourable peace?
I don't think it is, continued Malfar. It is all a nonsense. Abilene has run the army down until it is only a tenth of the size it was a few years ago. The navy has been halved. This dross was last under siege 2 centuries ago, when it almost fell. Yet our records tell us that we had 40,000 warriors in the field.
Get on with it, man. Make your point, said Druss.
I shall, but spare me your harsh looks, Druss. I am no coward. What I am saying is this. If we cannot hold and cannot win, what is the point of this defence?
Orin glanced at Druss, and the old warrior leaned forward.
The point is, he said, that you don't know whether you've lost until you've lost. Anything can happen. Ulrich could suffer a stroke. Plague could hit the Nadir forces. We have to try to hold.
What about the women and children? Asked Bacta, a skull-faced lawyer and property owner.
What about them? Said Druss. They can leave at any time.
To go where, pray? And with what monies?
Ye gods! Thundered Druss, surging to his feet. What will you be wanting me to do next? Where they go, if they do, how they go, is their concern and yours. I am a soldier, and my job is to fight and kill, and believe me, I do that very well. We have been ordered to fight to the last, and that we will do. Now, I may not know very much about law and all the little niceties of city politics, but I do know this. Any man who speaks of surrender during the coming siege is a traitor, and I will see him hang.
Well said, Druss, offered Beric, a tall middle-aged man with shoulder-length grey hair. I couldn't have put it better myself. Very stirring.
He smiled as Druss sank back to his seat.
There is one point, though. You say you have been asked to fight to the end. That order can always be changed. Politics being what it is, the question of expediency comes into it. At the moment, it is expedient for Abilene to ask us to prepare for war. He may feel it gives him greater bargaining power with Ulrich. Ultimately, though, he must consider surrender. Facts are facts. The tribes have conquered every nation they have attacked, and Ulrich is a general above comparison. I suggest we write to Abilene and urge him to reconsider this war.
Orin shot Druss a warning glance.
Very well put, Beric, he said. Obviously, Druss and I, as loyal military men, must vote against. However, feel free to write, and I will see the petition is forwarded with the first available rider.
Thank you, Orin. That is very civilized of you, said Beric.
Now, can we move on to the subject of the demolished homes?
Ulrich sat before the brazier, a sheepskin cloak draped over his naked torso. Before him squatted the skeletal figure of his shaman, Nosta Khan.
What do you mean?
Ulrich asked him.
As I said, I can no longer travel over the fortress. There is a barrier to my power. Last night, as I floated over Deathwalker, I felt a force, like a storm wind. It pushed me back beyond the outer wall.
And you saw nothing?
No, but I sensed, felt,
speak.
It is difficult. In my mind I could feel the sea and a slender ship. It was a fragment only. Also there was a mystic with white hair. I have puzzled long over this. I believe Deathwalker has called upon a white temple.
And their power is greater than yours, said Ulrich.
Merely different, hedged the shaman.
If they are coming by sea, then they will make for Dros Podol, said Ulrich, staring into the glimmering coals. Seek them out.
The shaman closed his eyes, freed the chains of his spirit, and soared free of his body. Formless, he raced high above the plain, over hills and rivers, mountains and streams, skirting the Delnok range, until at last the sea lay below him, shimmering beneath the stars. Far he roved before sighting Wastrel, picking out the tiny glint of her aft lantern. Swiftly he dropped from the sky to hover by the mast. By the port rail stood a man and a woman. Gently he probed their minds, then drifted down through the wooden deck, beyond the hold, and on to the cabins. These he could not enter, however. As lightly as the whisper of a sea breeze, he touched the edge of the invisible barrier. It hardened before him, and he recoiled. He floated to the deck, closing on the mariner at the stern, smiled, then raced back towards the waiting Nadir warlord. Nasta Khan's body trembled, and his eyes opened.
"Well?" asked Ulrich.
"I found them."
"Can you destroy them?"
"I believe so. I must gather my acolytes." On Wastrel, Vintar rose from his bed, his eyes troubled, his mind uneasy. He stretched.
"You felt it too,"
pulsed Serbitar, swinging his long legs clear of the second bed.
"Yes, we must be wary."
"He did not try to breach the shield," said Serbitar. "Was that a sign of weakness or confidence?"
"I don't know," answered the abbot.
Above them, at the stern, the second mate rubbed his tired eyes, slipped a looped rope over the wheel, and transferred his gaze to the stars. He had always been fascinated by these flickering, far-off candles. Tonight they were brighter than usual, like gems strewn on a velvet cloak. A priest had once told him there were holes in the universe through which the bright eyes of the gods gazed down on the peoples of the earth. It was a pretty nonsense, but he had enjoyed listening. Suddenly he shivered. Turning, he lifted his cloak from the aft rail and slung it about his shoulders. He rubbed his hands. Floating behind him, the spirit of Nasta Khan lifted its hands, focusing power upon the long fingers. Talons grew, glinting like steel, serrated and sharp. Satisfied, he closed in on the mariner, plunging his hands into the man's head. Searing agony blanketed the brain within as the man staggered and fell, blood pouring from his mouth and ears and seeping from his eyes. Without a sound, he died. Nasta Khan loosened his grip. Drawing on the power of his acolytes, he willed the body to rise, whispering words of obscenity in a language long erased from the minds of ordinary men. Darkness swelled around the corpse, shifting like black smoke to be drawn in through the bloody mouth. The body shuddered and rose. Unable to sleep, Virai dressed silently, climbed to the deck and wandered to the port rail. The night was cool, the soft breeze soothing. She gazed out over the waves to the distant line of land silhouetted against the bright, moonlit sky. The view always calmed her, the blending of land and sea. As a child at school in Drospurdol, she had delighted in sailing, especially at night when the land mass appeared to float like a sleeping monster of the deep, dark and mysterious and wonderfully compelling. Suddenly she narrowed her eyes. Was the land moving? To her left, the mountains seemed to be receding, while on the right the shoreline seemed closer. No, not seemed. Was. She glanced at the stars. The ship had veered northwest, yet they were days from Pordol. Puzzled, she walked aft towards the second mate as he stood with hands on the wheel. "Where are we heading?" she asked him, mounting the four steps to the stern and leaning on the rail. His head turned towards her, blank, blood-red eyes locked on hers, as his hands left the wheel and reached for her. Fear entered her soul like a lance, only to be quelled by rising anger. She was not some Drenai milkmaid to be terrified thus. She was Virai, and she carried the blood of warriors in her veins.
Dropping her shoulder, she threw a right-hand punch to his jaw. His head snapped back, but still he came on. Stepping inside the groping arms, she grabbed his hair and smashed a headbutt into his face. He took it without a sound, his hands curling round her throat. Twisting desperately before the grip tightened, she threw him with a rolling hip-lock, and he hit the deck hard on his back. Virai staggered. He rose slowly and came for her again. Running forward, she leapt into the air and twisted, hammering both feet into his face. He fell once more and rose. Panicked now, Virai searched for a weapon, but there was nothing. Smoothly, she vaulted the wheel rail to land on the deck. He followed her.
"Move away from him!"
screamed Serbitar, racing forward with sword drawn. Virai ran to him.
"Give me that,"
she said, tearing the sword from his hand. Confidence surged in her as her hand gripped the ebony hilt.
"Now, you son of a slut,"
she shouted, striding towards the mariner. He made no effort to avoid her, and the sword flashed in the moonlight, slicing into his exposed neck. Twice more she struck, and the grinning head toppled from the body. But the corpse did not fall. Oily smoke oozed from the severed neck to create a second head, formless and vague. Coal red eyes glittered within the smoke.
"Get back!"
shouted Serbitar.
"Get away from him!"
This time she obeyed, backing towards the albino.
"Give me the sword."
Vintar and Rek had joined them.
"What on earth is it?"
whispered Rek.
"Nothing on earth," replied Vintar.
The thing stood its ground, arms folded across its chest.
"The ship is heading for the rocks," said Virai,
and Serbitar nodded. "It is keeping us from the wheel. What do you think, Father Abbot?" "The spell was planted in the head, which must be thrown overboard. The beast will follow it," replied Vintar.
"Attack it."
Serbitar moved forward, supported by Rek. The corpse bent its body, right hand closing on the head of the severed head. Holding the head to its chest, it waited for the attack. Rek leapt forward, slashing a cut at the arm. The corpse staggered. Serbitar ran in, slicing the tendons behind the knee. As it fell, Rek hammered the blade two-handed across its arm. The arm fell clear, the fingers releasing the head, which rolled across the deck. Dropping his sword, Rek dived at it. Swallowing his revulsion, he lifted it by the hair and hurled it over the side. As it hit the waves, the corpse on the deck shuddered. As if torn by a great wind, the smoke flowed from the neck to vanish beneath the rail and into the darkness of the deep. The captain came forward from the shadows by the mast.
"What was it?"
he asked. Vintar joined him, placing a hand gently on the man's shoulder. "We have many enemies," he said. "They have great powers. But fear not, we are not powerless, and no harm will befall the ship again, I promise you." "And what of his soul?" asked the captain, wandering to the rail. "Have they taken it?" "It is free," said Vintar. "Believe me."
"We will all be free," said Rek, "if someone doesn't turn the ship away from those rocks."
In the darkened tent of Nostakhan, the acolytes silently backed out, leaving him sitting in the center of the circle, chalked on the dirt floor. Lost in thought, Nostakhan ignored them. He was drained and angry, for they had bested him, and he was a man unused to defeat. It tasted bitter in his mouth. He smiled. There would be another time. Chapter 16. Blessed by a following wind, Wastrel sped north until, at last, the silver-grey towers of Dros Purdol broke the line of the horizon. The ship entered the harbour a little before noon, piloting past the Drenai war triremes and the merchant vessels anchored in the bay. On the milling docks, street traders sold charms, ornaments, weapons and blankets to mariners, while burly dockers carried provisions up swaying gangplanks, stacking cargo and checking loads. All was noise and apparent confusion. The harbour side was rich in colour and the hectic pace of city life, and Rek felt a pang of regret to be leaving the ship. As Serbitar led the 30 ashore, Rek and Virai said their goodbyes to the captain.
With one exception, it has been a more than pleasant voyage, Virai told him. I thank you for your courtesy.
I was glad to be of service, my lady. I will forward the marriage papers to Drennan on my return. It was a first for me. I have never taken part in the wedding of an earl's daughter, much less conducted one. I wish you well. Bending forward, he kissed her hand. He wanted to add long life and happiness, but he knew their destination. Virai strode down the gangplank as Rek gripped the captain's hand. He was surprised when the man embraced him. May your sword arm be strong, your spirit lucky, and your horse swift when the time comes, he said. Rek grinned. The first two I will need. As to the horse, do you believe that lady will consider flight? No, she's a wonderful lass. Be lucky.
I will try hard, said Rek.
At the quayside, a young red-caped officer eased his way through the crowd to confront Serbitar.
Your business in Dros Perdol? He asked. We are travelling to Delnok as soon as we can obtain horses, answered the albino.
The fortress will soon be under siege, sir. Are you aware of the coming war?
We are. We travel with the Lady Virai, daughter of Earl Delnar, and her husband Regnag.
Seeing Virai, the officer bowed.
A pleasure, my lady. We met at your 18th birthday celebration last year. You probably won't remember me. On the contrary, Dundigas. We danced, and I trod on your foot. You were most kind and took the blame.
Digas smiled and bowed again. How she had changed, he thought. Where was the clumsy girl who had contrived to trip on the hem of her skirt? Who had blushed as red as the wine when, during a heated conversation, she had crushed a crystal goblet, drenching the woman to her right? What had changed? She was the same woman-girl he remembered, her hair mousy blonde, her mouth too wide, her brows thunder-dark over deep-set eyes. He saw her smile as Rek stepped forward, and his question was answered. She had become desirable.
"What are you thinking, Degas?" she asked. "You look far away."
"My apologies, my lady. I was thinking Earl Pindak will be delighted to receive you."
"You will have to convey my regrets," said Virai, "for we must leave as soon as possible. Where can we purchase mounts?"
"I am sure we can find you good horses," said Degas. "It is a shame you did not arrive sooner, since 4 days ago we sent 300 men to Delnok to aid the defence. You could have travelled with them. It would have been safer. The Setuli have grown bold since the Nadir threat." "We shall get there," said the tall man with Virai. Degas's eyes measured him. A soldier, he thought, or has been at some time. Carries himself well. Degas directed the party to a large inn, promising to supply the horses within 2 hours. True to his word, he returned with a troop of Drenai cavalrymen riding 32 horses. They were not of the pedigree of the mounts left behind in Lentria, being mustangs bred for mountain work, but they were sturdy animals. When the horses had been allocated and the provisions packed, Degas approached Rek. "There is no charge for these mounts, but I would be obliged if you could deliver these dispatches to the Earl. They came by sea from Drenan yesterday and missed our force. The one with the red seal is from Abilene."
"The Earl will receive them," said Rek. "Thank you for your help."
"It is nothing. Good luck."
The officer moved on to make his farewells to Virai. Pushing the letters into the saddlebag of his roan mare, Rek mounted and led the party west from Perdol, along the line of the Delnok Mountains. Serbitar cantered alongside him as they entered the first of the deep woods beyond the town.
"You look troubled," said Rek.
"Yes. There will be outlaws, renegades, perhaps deserters, and certainly Setuli tribesmen along our route."
"But that is not what troubles you?"
"You are perceptive," said Serbitar.
"How true. But then I saw the corpse walk."
"Indeed you did," said Serbitar.
"You have hedged about that night for long enough," said Rek. "Now give me the truth of it. Do you know what it was?"
"Vintar believes it to be a demon summoned by Nostakhan. He is the head shaman to Ulrich's Wolf's Head tribe, and therefore lord of all Nadir shaman. He is old, and it is said he first served Ulrich's great-grandfather. He is a man steeped in evil."
"And his powers are greater than yours?"
"Individually, yes. Collectively, I don't think so.
We are presently stopping him from entering Delnok, but he in turn has cast a veil over the fortress, and we cannot enter. Will he attack us again? Asked Greg. Assuredly. The question is what method he will choose. I think I will leave you to worry about that, said Rek. I can only take in so much gloom in one day. Zerbitar did not answer him. Rek reined his mount and waited for Virai. That night they camped by a mountain stream, but lit no fires. In the early evening, Vintar recited poetry, his voice soft and melodious, his words evocative. They are his own work, Zerbitar whispered to Virai. Though he will not own to them, I know not why. He is a fine poet. But they are so sad, she said. All beauty is sad, replied the albino, for it fades. He left her and retreated to a nearby willow, sitting with his back to the tree, a silver ghost in the moonlight. Arbadak joined Rek and Virai, handing them honey cakes he had purchased at the port. Rek glanced over at the lonely figure of the albino. He travels, said Arbadak. Alone. As the dawn birdsong began, Rek groaned and eased his aching body away from the probing tree roots which were denting his side. His eyes opened. Most of the 30 were still asleep, though tall Antaheim stood sentry by the stream. At the willow, Zerbitar remained where he had been during the recital. Rek sat up and stretched, his mouth dry. Pushing back his blanket, he walked to the horses, removed his pack, rinsed his mouth with water from his canteen, and went to the stream. Taking out a bar of soap, he stripped the shirt from his chest and knelt by the swift, rushing water.
"Please don't do that," said Antaheim.
"What?"
The tall warrior walked across to him, squatting by his side. "The soap bubbles will carry on downstream. It is not wise thus to announce her movements."
Rek cursed himself for a fool and apologized swiftly.
"That is not necessary. I am sorry to have intruded. Do you see that plant there, by the lichen rock?"
Rek twisted, then nodded.
"It is a lemon mint. Wash in the water, then crush some of the leaves and clean your body. It will refresh you and create a more pleasant aroma."
"Thank you. Is Zerbitar still traveling?"
"He should not be. I will seek him." Antaheim closed his eyes for several seconds. When they opened again, Rek recognized panic and the warrior ran from the stream. In that moment, all members of the 30 surged from their blankets and raced to Zerbitar by the willow. Rek dropped his shirt and soap on the bank and moved to join them. Vintar was bending over the albino's still form. He closed his eyes and placed his hands on the young leader's slender face. For long moments he remained thus. Sweat broke out upon his forehead and he began to sway. When he lifted a hand, Menahem joined him instantly, raising Serbitar's head. The swarthy warrior lifted the albino's right eyelid. The iris was red as blood. Virai dropped to her knees beside Rek.
"His eyes are green normally," she said. "What is happening?"
"I don't know," said Rek. Antaheim rose from the group and sprinted for the undergrowth, returning minutes later with what appeared to be an armful of vine leaves, which he tipped to the ground. Gathering dried twigs, he fashioned a small fire. Then, setting up a tripod of branches, he hung a pot above the flames, filled it with water, and crushed the leaves between his palms, dropping them into the pot. Soon the water began to bubble, and a sweet aroma filled the air. Antaheim lifted the pan from the flames, adding cold water from his canteen, then transferred the green liquid to a leather-covered pottery mug, which he passed to Menahem. Slowly they opened Serbitar's mouth, and, while Vintar held the albino's nostrils, they poured in the liquid. Zerbitar gagged and swallowed, and Vintar released his nose. Menahem laid his head back on the grass, and Antaheim swiftly killed the fire. There had been no smoke.
"What's going on?" asked Rek as Vintar approached him.
"We will talk later," said Vintar. "Now I must rest." He stumbled to his blankets and lay down, slipping instantly into a deep, dreamless sleep.
"I feel like a one-legged man in a foot race," said Rek. Menahem joined them, his dark face grey with exhaustion, as he sipped water from a leather canteen. He stretched his long legs out on the grass and lay on his side, supporting himself on his elbow. He turned towards Rek.
"I didn't mean to eavesdrop," he said, "but I did overhear you. You must forgive Vintar. He is older than the rest of us, and the strain of the hunt proved too much for him."
"The hunt? What hunt?" asked Virai.
"We sought Surbitar. He had journeyed far, and the path was sundered. He could not return, and we had to find him. Vintar guessed rightly that he had retreated into the mist and taken his chances. He had to seek him."
"I'm sorry, Menahem. You look worn out," said Rek. "But try to remember that we do not know what you are talking about. Into the mists. What the devil does that mean?"
Menahem sighed. "How can one explain colors to a blind man?"
"One says," snapped Rek, "that red is like silk, blue is like cool water, and yellow is like sunshine on the face."
"Forgive me, Rek. I am tired. I did not mean to be rude," said Menahem. "I cannot explain the mists to you as I understand them, but I will try to give you some idea. There are many futures, but only one past. When we travel beyond ourselves, we walk a straight path, journeying much as we are doing now. We direct ourselves over vast distances. But the path back remains solid, for it is locked in our memories. Do you understand?"
"So far," said Rek. "Virai? I'm not an idiot, Rek. Sorry. Go on, Menahem."
"Now try to imagine there are other paths. Not just from, say, Drenan to Delnok, but from today into tomorrow. Tomorrow has not yet happened, and the possibilities for it are endless. Each one of us makes a decision that will affect tomorrow. But let us say we do travel into tomorrow. Then we are faced with a multitude of paths, gossamer thin and shifting. In one tomorrow, Drostelnok has already fallen. In another, it has been saved, or is about to fall, or about to be saved. Already we have four paths. Which is true? And when we tread the path, how do we return to today, which, from where we are standing, is a multitude of yesterdays? To which do we return? Surbitar journeyed far beyond tomorrow, and Vintar found him as we held the path in sight."
"You used the wrong analogy," said Rek. "It is nothing like explaining colors to a blind man. Rather, it is more like teaching archery to a rock. I haven't the remotest idea what you're talking about. Will Surbitar be all right?"
"We don't know yet. If he lives, he will have information of great value."
"What happened to his eyes? How did they change color?" asked Virai.
"Surbitar is an albino, a true albino. He needs certain herbs in order to maintain his strength. Last night he journeyed too far and lost his way. It was foolhardy. But his heartbeat is strong, and he is now resting."
"Then he won't die," said Rek.
"That we cannot say. He travelled a path which stretched his mind. It could be he will suffer the pull. This sometimes happens to travellers. They move so far from themselves that they just drift, like smoke. If his spirit is broken, it will pass from him and return to the mist."
"Can't you do anything?"
"We have done all we can. We cannot hold him forever."
"When will we know?" asked Rek.
"When he awakes. If he awakes."
The long morning wore on, and Surbitar still lay unmoving. The 30 volunteered no conversation, and Virai had walked upstream to bathe. Bored and tired, Rek took the dispatches from his pouch. The bulky scroll, sealed in red wax, was addressed to Earl Delnar. Rek broke the seal and spread the letter wide. In flowing script, the message read, "My dear friend,
Even as you read this, our intelligence is that Nadir will be upon you. We have tried repeatedly to secure peace, having offered all that we have, save the right to govern ourselves as a free people. Ulrich will have none of this. He wishes to secure for himself a kingdom stretching beyond the northern and southern seas. I know the Dross cannot hold, and I therefore rescind my order that you fight to the last. It will be a battle without profit and without hope. Woundweaver is, needless to say, against this policy, and has made it clear that he will take his army into the hills as a raiding force, should the Nadir be allowed to pass to the Sentran Plain. You are an old soldier, and the decision must be yours. Pin the blame for surrender upon me. It is mine by right, since I have brought the Drenai people to this parlous state. Do not think of me unkindly. I have always tried to do that which was best for my people. But perhaps the years have told more heavily upon me than I realized, for my wisdom has been lacking in my dealings with Ulrich. It was signed simply, Abilene, and below the signature,